Okay, we are into the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. My goal is to finish this tomorrow morning, and then we have Song of Solomon. So we're going to kind of plow along here. If we remember, two main messages we're going to hear over and over again in Ecclesiastes is all is vanity, and this is on that introduction handout I gave you. The one message is all is vanity. And the second is fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. All His vanity appears in chapter 1, verse 2. And the second message, fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, appears in chapter 12, verse 13. It's interesting, they're kind of like bookends. And yet those themes keep popping up over and over again. Vanity, of course, is related to uselessness, the futility of life. This idea, all is vanity, life is like a puff of wind, a mere breath. You can't quite put your hands around it. But that would be a very distressful, skeptical, depressing message, except it goes along with the key phrase, under the sun. And so, although some scholars, some people see Ecclesiastes as being a very depressing book, it really isn't. It's actually, if you parse through it and study it carefully, it's really upbeat. It's telling us if we only look at life or experience life from a perspective that this is all there is under the sun, this physical existence, I guess we'd say that's kind of a downer. That doesn't get us too excited because there's a lot of problems in life. But if you step back and realize there's something much more than just this existence under the sun, this physical existence, then there's much greater hope. And of course, this book, like all books of the Bible, we can read it separately apart from the larger book, the Bible, you might say, but we must always read it at the same time within the larger context. And of course, understanding of the gospel message, God's plan of salvation, we do know that there's a much more positive, there's a very positive message here. So let's begin chapter 1, verse 12, where we left off. Solomon had talked about his observations. He just kind of gives us a quick rundown of some of the basic things he sees going on in life, verses 4 through 11. And what we get is this idea of almost a monotony. It's monotonous. These things keep happening over and over again. The sun rises and the sun goes down. And you wait a while and the sun rises and the sun goes down. You wait a while and the sun rises and it's monotonous. And it's a cycle. And Solomon was very quick to see, just as we do, that there are a lot of cycles in life. Life is cyclical. We are born, we grow old, we die. It rains into the sea, and then he says the water goes back up in the clouds and it comes down again. And so he sees throughout life these cycles, and that seems rather monotonous. It seems like it's just the same thing over and over again. And so then he decides in verse 12, he tells us in verses 12 through 18, in essence what he does here in verses 12 through 18 is that he summarizes an investigation he undertook. And he's going to share with us what we might say the outcome of his investigation. What is he going to investigate? He's going to investigate, well, what is life all about? He's going to try to come up with the idea of what is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of our existence? And it's interesting, Solomon very early on shows what we'd call the empirical method, you might say. We call it the basic, what I learned back in high school, and I probably forget some parts of it, of science. There's the observation, you come up with a hypothesis, I believe it is, and then you experiment, you observe. And there's some other steps. I forget what it all is now. I went into English, not science, so I guess that's where I'm a little thin on the science part. But he does this investigation, and then he's going to offer conclusions, and that's what he does here. Pretty much he's offering us his investigation and his conclusions, and then what follows in chapter 2 and elsewhere, he's going to start describing some of his things he learned in detail. We might say that Solomon was searching for meaning in life. And Viktor Frankl and other writers in our century, there are all sorts of books about the meaning of life, man's search for meaning in life. Solomon was early at it back in when he was king in the 900s AD. Excuse me, that would be crazy. 900s BC. Verse 12, he writes, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. There's his task. This is his investigation. He's going to search out. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men. Let me back up. Verse 13, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. I'm going to look out for the meaning in life. This burdensome task, this task of finding out what is life all about, God has given to the sons of men, by which they may be exercised. So it seems that Solomon is suggesting that all of us should be interested in understanding what life is all about. Human beings, there's something different about human beings from animals. We have an intellect. We have a mind that's far different than animal minds. And it seems there's something in us that wants to know. We want to know. We have this drive that is, you could call it curiosity. We have this drive to want to learn more. We're sending spaceships to Mars. Hubble has discovered a new hidden, what do they call it, galaxy, I guess, they're talking about this past weekend online. Man has this drive to learn more and more and more and more. And what they learn is that things are interesting, but they're physical. They still don't quite make sense for man's meaning. And, of course, much what man investigates, they're doing it without understanding that God does exist and that there's a larger plan on the spiritual realm. But it seems God has placed in our hearts and minds a desire to learn. We want to know, why are we here? We want to know, what is life about? What is the purpose? This is that burdensome task God has given to the sons of men, by which they may be exercised. And hopefully, with God's help and the humility, they'll come to see that there is a God and that life does make sense when God is in the picture. Verse 14, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. He studied it all. He's contemplated it. And he says, and indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. That's an interesting phrase there. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. Of course, under the sun, that would be true, suggesting that man's efforts to make things better, man's effort to make straight what is crooked, never really lasts for long. I can give you an example, simple example. You ever driven on a brand new road that's newly paved? I mean, it's so quiet when you drive your car over. It just hums. It's got a little tune. It's just a nice, quiet tune. How long does the road stay that way? Pretty soon it gets crooked, meaning you get chuck holes. We call them chuck holes. Or they had a brand new road down there in Big Sandy, Texas. I remember this years ago. They just newly paved it. It was so sweet. It was so nice to drive on. You know, it just hummed. 2 weeks later, the city decided they had to dig a trench across it because I never understood why. 2-3 weeks later, it's, you know, and vanity. That's the way life is. What's ever smooth isn't smooth very long. Jake, you got a comment, question?
Yeah, I'm sure you already explained this, but would I be able to get just an explanation of what under the sun means?
It seems to suggest under the sun, meaning that on this earth. Okay? And scholars see this as a metaphor for this physical existence. So our lives, if you think about it, human life, time is, from a human perspective, time is defined by the rising and setting of the sun, the 24 hours. And so it becomes a metaphor for time, for our limited existence. God created the earth and the heavens and the earth. He, in essence, in that way, from a human perspective, he created time. God exists outside of time. It's kind of hard to grasp that. But God created the universe. He created time, but yet he's outside of it. You know, it's like his hands hold, metaphorically speaking, his hands hold the universe as vast as it is. And yet from our human perspective, our time is dictated by the rising and setting of the sun. That defines a day. Genesis 1, verse 3 through 31. You know, that defines the week. It defines time. It's very limited. So the metaphor under the sun, scholars recognize that is concerning us, our physical human existence. And of course, with God's gospel message and the message revealed to us through other parts of the scripture, we recognize that there's life beyond this that's under the sun, and that is immortal. And emphasizes, we're going to see later when he talks about death, that we are mortal beings. We are physical beings. We are created from the dust of the earth. We do not have immortality. Okay, does that help? So, no, the idea is, as much as humanity tries to straighten things, to make things better, create peace, make a perfect society, get rid of wars, whatever, it never lasts for long. It's never straight. It's never good and perfect very long, if ever. And what is lacking, what needs to be improved upon, what needs to be better, cannot be numbered. That's part of this human existence. I communed with my heart, verse 16, saying, look, I have attained greatness. I have gained more wisdom than all who are before me in Jerusalem, Solomon says, the preacher. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And so then he says, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And so we get this two paths again, don't we? Just like we saw in Proverbs. And so Solomon sets out to, he wants to understand what life is about. It seems he understood that there is wisdom and there is folly. He remembered something of what he was taught by his mother and father, and now he wants to understand that a little bit more. The word for folly here is a word that apparently only appears in Ecclesiastes. It could mean silliness or madness. In Hebrew, or the English transliteration? Sikluth. And apparently, from what I was reading, it only appears in Ecclesiastes. Typically, it means silliness or madness, and it can also mean those who are impious. So it is, again, akin to what we saw with regards to fools or foolishness in Proverbs. It's the same idea. In wisdom, he says, set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. It seems madness and folly are kind of put together. In other words, it's craziness. The opposite of wisdom is kind of like, it would be an insane thing to do. I perceive that this is also grasping for the wind. And madness and folly, it seems to be what he's talking about. And even wisdom can have its own downside, you might think. And here's what he explains. He says, for much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, when we read that, we might be thinking, well, if becoming wise just causes us to have more sadness, then why would we seek to be wise? Well, it's Solomon is speaking from his own experience, and I think we can relate to this. What he seems to be suggesting is that those who seek wisdom take life seriously, and they don't take life frivolously anymore. You begin to realize that there is a different way of living we must be living. The idea here is that the more wisdom you have, the more, well, what wisdom is related in God's law, for example, the more you understand God's commandments and the need to keep them, it does become a little more sad, and we look at the world and we recognize if people would just start doing what God says, things would be better. And that does cause us to be a bit sad. Sad because we know there is a solution there that humanity, even us ourselves individually, we can still choose to ignore. And that can cause us to be a little more sad, have a little more grief. And so oftentimes the more we learn about wisdom, the more we learn about right living, we do become a little more serious-minded. It doesn't mean we don't have fun in life, that we don't enjoy life or anything like that. But we recognize that life is a serious thing, that we recognize that life is nothing we should throw away. We shouldn't throw away our time in endless frivolity, in silliness, and that sort of thing. Although it's kind of fun to be silly in a right fun way, if you know what I mean, to have fun, eat, drink, and enjoy the good things of life too. Continuing on, chapter 2, verse 1. And so Solomon continues on now. He says, I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with mirth. He's going to test life. He's going to see what life's about. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely this was also vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and mirth, what does it accomplish? Mirth is, another word for mirth is merriment. Some may equate that with partying, you know, just living life without any concern for the consequences. I think we know better than that. But many people just live life for what it is, and they don't worry about what tomorrow may bring. That, Solomon is suggesting, that kind of way of life, that kind of laughter, mirth, carelessness, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, silliness, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. So this is back to part of his experiment he was going to try. Now, some would say, oh, well, he took time in his life to party hard. He became a party animal. He got drunk. He tried all these things. That's not exactly what it says. In fact, that's probably not what he did. It said, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. That's an important point. It seems that he contemplated what life was about if you would just indulge the senses with drinking, with eating, with partying, giving into all the pleasures. He contemplated it. He probably did enough to recognize the outcome. He could look around him. He could see people that practice that way of life without having to experience it himself. It does not necessarily suggest that he lived a life of immorality. That's a lot of conservative scholars look at that in that phrase, while guiding my heart with wisdom. That seems to be a caveat Solomon is throwing in there to let us know that he didn't give into sinfulness, this sort of sinful lifestyle, just to test it. Here's some other things he did with his abilities. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. So he's doing everything good and positive that he could experiment about what the good things in life are about. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the son of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. And so I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. So he had all that money could buy, and so he tried it all. He did beautiful building projects. He had these beautiful gardens. He probably created this vast system of aqueducts and irrigation channels to water his garden, his fruit trees. You can imagine the flowers, the beautiful trees that were probably exotic to that part of the world that he brought in and made flourish. He had all these servants. He had everything a person back then would say is wealthy and powerful, flocks, herds, everything that rich people could do, he did. He loved music. You can see he was a connoisseur of the arts in his own way. Anything that could bring pleasure to the senses, he did, within wisdom, of course. Verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward in all my labor. And so his reward was the enjoyment, enjoying it, seeing the beautiful sights, the garden, hearing the beautiful music, all these things. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind, for there was no profit under the sun. So he did all these projects. He did all these wonderful things. Why, after doing all these things, do you suspect he still felt suddenly, when he looked at the works his hand had done, all the labor in which he had toiled, he suddenly felt there was still vanity and grasping for the wind? Why did he feel that way, even after doing all these things? Austin?
Because he knew that when you die, all those things that you have don't matter at all.
Yeah. We kind of go to the end of the story and we know what he's going to keep saying. Despite all these beautiful things he made, and we're going to hear it over and over again, none of it will stay. It's not going to stay perfect. As we read earlier, as straight and perfect as he tries to make things in time, it's going to go crooked. It's going to need repair. Even looking forward to his own life, he's not going to live forever to enjoy it forever. And that's part of the vanity. You try to hold on to something permanently, and it just slips through your fingers like your breath, like the wind. You just can't do it. And that's a frustration. No doubt you've been frustrated with some of that you've experienced in your own life. Money and earthbound pleasures do not lift us out of frustration. And ultimately, even he would know, as much as he's done, there's still a sense of emptiness. How many times have we wanted something badly and God has blessed us with our heart's desires? And what happens a little while later? What happens? We're not happy again, right? We just can't seem to stay happy for very long. And again, God has also placed something in our hearts. The way I would put it, it's like he has placed something in our hearts. There's a longing, not only a longing to find out what's life about, but there's a longing within our hearts. We are not quite ever going to be happy here under the sun. It's like we're always wanting some place to call home. Even at home, we're still not quite satisfied. There's something that the closest something that is satisfying in this life is home, but then there's something greater than home in my mind that I'm yearning for. And God's word tells us what it's about. It's a relationship with God and eternal and immortality. But most people just understand it as they're not happy. They're not satisfied. There's something they're constantly yearning for. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. He knew wisdom makes better sense than folly. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool's walk in darkness. Yet, even though the paths are quite different, one walks in light, one walks in darkness, he says, yet I myself perceived that the same event happens to them all. What event is that? Yeah, death. We all die. You know, and that's a frustrating thing. So I said in my heart, verse 15, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And so here's some great questions he's asking. Well, why was I then more wise? Why was I wiser? Why was I better off than the guy that doesn't obey God and walk in his ways? Because under the sun, you both end up in the grave. So what's the point? Why then was I more wise? And I said in my heart, well, this is also vanity. This is very frustrating. For there is no more remembrance of the wise and of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As a fool. And so when he steps back, he's looking at this as someone under the sun. He sees this is all very vain. It's foolishness. It's like chasing the wind. Because whether I do live as a wise man or live as a fool, we both end up in the grave sooner or later. And doesn't that seem meaningless? But as he makes clear, verse 17, he says, therefore I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing for me. For all is vanity and grasping for the wind. We should be frustrated if we only look at this life as it is, birth and death under the sun, as if that were all that there is. That is frustrating. And it is something not to like if that's all there is. But Solomon seemed to understand that he must have had an inkling that there's something beyond this physical existence. Now, how much he understood, I don't know. But he did trust God. We don't have to be frustrated because Christ's gospel gives us hope. We know there is something beyond this physical existence. But if all you know is a physical existence, you will feel frustration. That helps us to understand why people that have not been called of God, that have not welcomed God's gospel message, we can understand why people get frustrated. We can understand why maybe people we know, classmates through the years, maybe some of our family members, whoever God hasn't called, whoever doesn't understand what God's about, we can understand why they just kind of live the way they do. They don't really have a larger hope. But God has given us a hope. We have something larger to look forward to, something greater that makes walking the path of wisdom worthwhile and avoiding the path of the fool. It's wise to avoid that. And so if we only look at life under the sun, we will come to hate our labor like Solomon did, verse 18. If he pretended that's all there was under the sun, then all your labor is going to become hateful. Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be wise or fool. Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. And so he continues on with that thought on through verse 23. And so he comes up with understanding that why be proud of physical accomplishments that are only going to be left to others that come after me? And maybe they won't like it. Maybe they'll tear it down. Maybe they'll build something else there. And so his heart, he's showing this is the typical thing that people are going to think about. He's following this experiment, just looking at life under the sun. One of his conclusions here is verse 24, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul, his life should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. And so one of the things he says he recognizes we should do, we should eat and drink. We should enjoy the good things of this physical existence. We should enjoy that sense of accomplishment. One thing I tried to instill in my children at a very young age is, let's say it was time to clean the room. You know how much fun that is. Okay, let's pick up our toys. Let's put things back. But then after we were done, I made them stop. And I said, now stop and look at your room. How does that feel? And then you say, oh, it feels good. I said, doesn't it feel good to know everything's over here where it belongs? I go, yeah. And see, I think that's part what Solomon is saying. We should step back and enjoy our accomplishments. We should recognize what we've been able to achieve. And of course, we recognize we don't achieve it all by ourselves, but with the help of God and others. But that sense of accomplishment, that too is a blessing from God. That too is something we should enjoy along with the good food and the drink. That's part of the enjoyment God has allowed to us in this physical existence. Verse 26, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give it to him who is good before God. And so this is also vanity and grasping for the wind. The idea is, who is that vanity and grasping for the wind? For the sinner, that is. For the sinner who does not know God, it seems their lives are useless in many ways. But if you're close to God, life will have meaning. Therefore, it's best to live, in my own words here, it's best to live a life that pleases God. You will have far less distress and worry. Physical life of itself brings no lasting happiness. And as we'll see, it's only a proper relationship with God that will do that. Of course, 1 Timothy 6 through 19, Paul tells us it's a blessing to be contented with what God blesses us with and to live a life of obedience to Him. So it's a good blessing if we can accept what life is about. And of course, the best way to live this life under the sun is with God in mind and in obedience to His commandments. Now, as we continue to Ecclesiastes 3, and we start getting more of Solomon's insights of his observations from life. Remember, he took it upon himself to treat life as an observer. He studied everything that happened in human existence day by day under the sun, and he thought about it, and these are some of his conclusions he's going to come up with. Ecclesiastes 3, it starts out verses 1 through 8. It begins with some basic observations of life. Part of what he tells us here is that there is a fitting time for everything to be done in accordance to God's purpose. There is a fitting time for everything to be done in accordance to God's purpose. The idea here is that part of what we need to do under the sun is to take life day by day from the hand of God and to understand that God has a fitting time for everything. We may not like what's happening to us, but God apparently allows things to happen to us. Perhaps there is something there for us. It is fitting that we go through whatever that might be at that time. And also here, when we look at verses 1 through 8, it seems to be suggesting that as human beings, we need to discern the right time for the right decisions. We need to understand that there's a right time for certain things. You know, as a young man, early on, I decided, well, I want to get married. I want to be married. Okay. I didn't have a degree. I didn't have a career. Still living in college with mom and dad. But I wanted to get married. Was that a bad thing? No, I'm not seeing anybody say anything. No, it's not a bad thing. You know, if that's what you want and God blesses you with it, it's not a bad thing. But what was going on, of course, I was nowhere prepared for marriage. And it's something I've talked to young people about. It's not a, you know, there's a time to build, there's a time to plant, there's a time to build your, be building your foundation, you might say, for what life comes ahead. You got to be building your house, building your, planting your fields, preparing for the future. And then at the right time, as God would so be pleased, and if there's another special someone that is pleased with you, a future spouse, well, then the time would be right. But there has to be a time for every good thing, a fitting time according to God's purpose. Verse 1 of chapter 3, to everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, under the sun. There is a time to be born and a time to die. We're going to see this cycle, these cyclical things Solomon's talking about. But here he's not rejecting them. He's just saying this is the way it is, and it's good to accept these things. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck what is planted. There is a time to kill and a time to heal. There is a time to break down and a time to build up. There is a time to weep and there is a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. And so we get the idea there's these contrasts in life and there's a time for all of these. It's not such that one is evil and one is good per se. That's not his point here. He's saying this is a part of what life is under the sun. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to gain and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. That's a hard time to figure out, isn't it? When do you say something? When do you not say something? Those are hard times. Verse 8, a time to love and a time to hate. Well, I thought we were not supposed to hate anything, Christ says. Are we allowed to hate anything? What are we allowed to hate? Sin. We're allowed to hate sin. We're allowed to hate evil. We're allowed to hate sin. There's a time for war, a time of war, and a time of peace. And so, over and over again, Solomon is pretty much, if somebody would ever say, well, what is life all about? You might just read them verses 1 through 8 of chapter 3. This is what human existence is. Solomon pretty much defined it. A very concise summary. And there's a fitting time for each of these in accordance to God's purpose. And so, we might ask ourselves what God's revealed purpose or plan is for each of these, such as birth and death, for example. God has a time for this, but man tends to interfere. For example, man has his own plan about things, which isn't always in agreement with God. You know, and we talked about this as we started a discussion of Proverbs. Human reasoning allows for abortion. Human reasoning allows for euthanasia. And scientists are constantly trying to make us live over or past beyond 100. I saw somewhere that they're thinking if they could fix, I love that, if they could fix the human gene, the human DNA, humanity could live to be 300-400 years old. Yeah, my response, so what? People lived that old before. You know, go back in the Old Testament. People lived well into their 100s, 200, 300, 700s. I don't know if it's necessarily a good thing. It doesn't seem like their lives are all that happy overall, unless they were righteous with God. These times are set by God, and humanity will get along better if we accept God's will when these times happen to us instead of trying to resist God's will through human means, and some of these means are euthanasia and elsewhere. God's got a plan, time for everything, and what's interesting, you might say, now is man's time, our time, if we are called, now is our time to learn from God. It's better to learn to experience life in obedience to God rather than life without God's influence in our lives. And so this is a summary of what life's about. And again, it can look like a rather drab list, but it's really not. There's a lot of beautiful, wonderful things that occur during that time. Verse 9, Solomon continues, What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? And here's his answer. He says, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, God has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. And that's interesting. He says, God has put eternity in their hearts. We don't have eternity as immortality. We are not immortal souls. But he has put this desire. We want something more than this physical existence. Now, we might look at that, and Solomon seems to suggest it here later on, that sense of eternity in our hearts, that desire for something more than this physical existence, that seems to elevate us above the animal world. Animals don't seem to worry too much about, you know, what happens to them after they die, from what we can tell. Animals live very much in the present. Human beings live in the past and in the future at times, maybe too much, neither. So it is interesting. God has made everything beautiful in its time. Even death at the right time, I guess, can be beautiful if it's according to God's will. That is something that might be a challenge for us to understand, but that can also be. And again, that would require a position of faith and trust in God that according to His will and time, it is for the better. It is for the best, actually. Verse 14 through 15, Solomon, this is almost, I read this as a statement of faith or trust that Solomon has in God. And it's something we might want to cling to when God allows us to go through a time of suffering, a time of troubles. Verse 14 through 15, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before Him. That which is has already been, and that which is to be has already been. And God requires an account of all that is past. This is something we really need to, you can spend a lot of time thinking about, parsing, studying, analyzing. We get the sense that he's saying that God's in charge. God is going to oversee all that goes on. And if we can just understand that God is in control, life is going to be far more enjoyable and satisfying than always trying to figure out, well, why did God do this to me? Why did God do that or not do this or that? Part of that requires humility and a simple trust that believing God and obeying God, that faith and trust in God we need, will be all right. Other statements. Verse 16, here's something else he saw. Moreover, I saw under the sun in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. So he's seeing that things are mixed up. Injustice was occurring. Wickedness was occurring where it should not have been occurring. And this is something we see in life as well. There is injustice. People cannot keep things straight. They make it crooked, even in the realm of righteousness and judgment. And I said in my heart, another statement of faith, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and every work. And so even in Solomon's examination of life, he saw there's injustice. Probably like us, Solomon wants to fix things. If I see injustice occurring, whether it's a bully picking on a little kid or a corporation stealing unfairly property from people, I get a strong sense of injustice and I want to do something about it. But yet I recognize maybe I'm not able to do anything about it. There is injustice in the world. It always will be. But Solomon is able to see that God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. That is a part of this human existence. And I said in my heart, concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see, He allows us to see that they themselves are like animals. How are we like animals? Verse 19, for what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. Now, I have to understand this. That is, as one dies, so dies the other. We all have that naphis, that breath of life. We animals and man or humanity are made from the dust of the ground. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantages over animals And that physical aspect for all is vanity. All go to one place. They all go back to the dirt. All are from the dust and all return to the dust. And then he makes this statement, who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward? You know, that God takes it, you might say, kind of stores aside, man, the spirit of the animal which goes down to the earth. So that's a question. How do we know? What proof do we have of that? What concrete evidence do we have? Well, we really don't. That's a statement of faith. That's a statement of trust. So I perceive that nothing is better than a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can see what will happen to him? In other words, we do believe that we are better than animals. We have this spirit of man. How do we know there is something after this physical life? That goes back to faith. That goes back to this revelation God has given to us. So let's say as a human being, you don't know if that's true or not. What would be the wiser thing to do if you don't know if you're just... Some people say we don't have a soul. When we die, we're just dead. That's what atheists say. Now, if you're going to be a wise person, what might be a better thing to do? It'd be better to believe God and obey God, or to say God doesn't exist and just live our life any old way? What would be the wiser thing to do? The wiser thing would be, shouldn't you go ahead and obey God, do what he says, strive to practice a life of faith? Because at least then after death, if you're right, there's God, and you're at the judgment seat. But if you lived your life totally against God, you've just given yourself a far more... Well, you put yourself in a different position possibly in the afterlife with God in the judgment seat, but you've also probably set yourself up for a more miserable life. If you do believe that God exists, you will keep his commandments, and that's going to give you a better life, ultimately, both physically and in the future. Let's go to chapter 4. Chapter 4, what we see occurring throughout Solomon, in many ways, is, remember, he's observing life under the sun. So you know what that is supposed to be like. As an observer, what do you do when you observe things? Let's say if you're somewhat of a scientist and you're merely an observer, what are you supposed to report?
The facts of what you saw.
That's right. When you're an observer, it used to be a tenet of journalism, although it's never been upheld, even since ancient times. But a tenet of journalism was the facts and only the facts. You know, just strict observation and let the people make up their own mind. That's never been possible because human beings cannot just see objectively, totally. Okay, but we should try. What Solomon is doing here, and again, is observing what he has seen under the sun. So just because Solomon makes certain statements doesn't necessarily mean that he approves of it, or he's saying this is the way we should live. Okay, I want to make sure that's clear. When we read Scripture, we have to make sure we understand the context. So a lot of things Solomon's going to tell us here, in essence, they're a fact of this human existence under the sun. Sometimes he'll say this is vanity, this is useless, this is wrong. Other times he just says this is the way life is. But if you understand, if you fear God and keep his commandments and understand that that's your whole duty, it'll give you perspective of what is right and wrong, that this is not a best way to live life. There is a way of life that is a path of wisdom and a path of foolishness. For example, here's a fact of life, chapter 4, verse 1 through 3. Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. He sees that human beings oppress other people. Now, he's not saying it's right. He's just saying, this is what I see. And we can look around our world today and see it too. Look, he says, continuing verse 1, and look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. They have no one there to fight their cause, to take up their cause. On the side of the oppressors, there is power. But they, the oppressed, they have no comforter. Go to court of law, it seems like if corporation is trying to, let's say, I'll make something up, corporation's trying to steal the land from a little farmer somewhere. The corporation has all these highly paid lawyers, and they can twist things and do things, and a little farmer, with maybe his court-appointed lawyer or something, I don't know, he can barely deal with it. And the rich and powerful oftentimes can get their way, which seems very unjust and unfair. That is a fact of life. Solomon says, therefore, I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has never seen the evil work is done under the sun. What's his point there? Why does he praise the dead that don't see this oppression? What's his point? Yes, Zoe?
Is it kind of like when you see all the evil, it makes, like, it's a horrific thing to see, and it makes, it's like emotionally hard and it scars you, so like it's better not to see that than to see it?
I think that's part of what he's saying. Sometimes, you know, when you understand the wickedness in the world, and you could think maybe you got a relative that died some years ago, and you think, wow, grandma never had to see that. I'm glad she didn't have to experience that. I mean, there is some understanding, you know, there. That's part of what Solomon's saying. You know, there is such oppression. There are so many bad things under the sun. Sometimes it makes you become philosophical and wonder, well, maybe it's better to be dead so you don't have to experience that. And again, that's him speaking. And of course, that seems rather dour and sad, but not if you understand that there's more to life than just what's under the sun. If you understand there is the resurrection and there is a time to come when people will be resurrected into a much better situation, you kind of get it. Now, did Solomon understand all that? I don't know. I don't know how much of that he understood. But with our larger context of Scripture, of the Bible, we understand that. And we can kind of extrapolate here and understand part of where we can draw more meaning. In one sense, the dead are in their own place where the dead, in other words, are no longer oppressed. You could say death is a place of safety in some ways. It is a place of safety. Verse 4 is another fact he's seen. I saw that for all the toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This is also vanity and grasping for the wind. And so what he's talking about, there's covetousness and jealousy is a fact of life. You could be someone that bought a bare lot in a rundown part of town, just a piece of dry dirt, not even grass will grow on it. But you could come in there and you can work hard and you can add new things to the soil and you could turn into this lush, almost like a garden, you know, a little paradise in the midst of the city. And suddenly, what does everybody want to buy? They want that lot. And some may even go to not so good means of trying to acquire it from you. And that's part of what's going on here. People that work hard or and do good things or accomplish positive things, they're going to be envied by their neighbor. It's just a fact of life. Verse 8, here's another fact of life. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. And so here Solomon recognizes that there are some people out there who are isolated. They're working hard. They're making all this money, but they're isolated. They don't have a family. They don't have children. They don't have a brother. It seems like they're out there all isolated from family, of extended family, or even within their own lives, no family. And yet they work hard. And they just keep in money that his eye is never satisfied with riches, but he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? So he recognizes there's some people out there that are, I guess you call them workaholics and miserly at the same time, and they build up all these riches for themselves. But for what, Solomon says? They don't share it. They don't give it away. They don't do good with it. And he says that's a fact of life. That is vanity. That's a miserable thing. He continues on this sort of idea in verse 9. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. And again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. You know, if you got two friends or three friends, you know, or maybe you got a four or five-fold cord. You know, the idea is, and it kind of ties into what we read here in verse 8, You know, being alone, being isolated is vanity. It makes life a little meaningless, futile. And so individualism is, you know, we talked about being individualistic, you know, independent. I'm not going to depend on anybody. That could be held up in human society as a wonderful thing. But what Solomon is suggesting here, but that's not such a wonderful thing. He's really talking about the benefits of relationships, isn't he? He's talking more specifically about the strength of a family relationship, and then he expands it, of course, to friendship, and almost suggesting that, well, we're not meant to be alone. I think we read that somewhere in Genesis. Man is not meant to be alone. It's good to have a companion. Working with others, we might add, is to succeed, is wise, and it brings benefits. It's not so self-centered. It becomes other-focused. Imagine how much better society would be if we had a little less selfishness and we actually worked harder on our relationships. And of course, we understand from Scripture that God is all about relationships. Commandments talk about love towards God and love towards neighbor. That's relationship-based. Yeah, George, yeah.
Going back to something that you just mentioned, that threefold cord is not soon broken. Going way, way back, I even as I was growing up, I remember being taught that that replies, ties into our relationship with God. Hmm. That a husband and a wife, or two individuals who are very, very close, when God is first and foremost in our lives, that cord is so strong that it's not soon broken. It could be broken because of what we do, mm-hmm. but not because of the strength that God puts in it.
That's a good point. When you make your marriage vows, it's not just between you and your spouse. It's you, your spouse, and God. It's a threefold cord. Very good. Very good point. And of course, if God is a part of all our relationships, even if God is a part of your friendships and your family relationships, that just makes it stronger. Absolutely. And again, it all ties back. Okay, there's a nice little segue. It ties, get it? That cord, that stream of thought ties back to the Ten Commandments. Verse 4, we break it down, saying it tells us how to relate to God more directly. And then the latter 6 tells us how to relate to our brothers and sisters, to our neighbor. Yeah. Okay. Very good. And here's another fact of life. Verse 13 through 16, you might call this about the vanity of popularity. Isn't popularity a big deal nowadays? Everyone wants to be popular. That's especially true if the younger you are. I think being popular is very important to you. Can you remember back when you used to worry about what you would wear to school because, what, you didn't want to be unpopular? You don't want to be made fun? You remember these things? You don't. Guys are going, nah, never worried about that. Okay. But you talk to some young people, or if you have kids of your own one day, you will know what I mean. You know, I can't wear that. I'll be laughed at. An older person, we've been there, done that. It doesn't mean anything to us anymore. It's like, who cares what they think? Well, you do care. Because being popular, fitting in with the crowd is very, very important. So part of what we see 13 through 16 could address this idea of getting along, being popular. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished or advised no more. And here we need a little help. NIV helps us. New King James says, the New King James says, for he comes out of prison to be king. NIV says, for the youth may have come out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. And then I'll just finish this. Verse 15, I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place, or they followed the youth, the king's successor. So he's setting up this idea as if the old king is being replaced by a young man. A younger person's going to inherit the throne, and that young man may even have come out of prison or something like that. It's kind of obscure meaning there. Verse 16, there is no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him, meaning they will not be pleased with the successor. Surely this is also vanity and grasping for the wind. Perhaps Solomon was... Notice what goes on when kings come and go and people take their place. Maybe he's looking forward to his own successor, Rehoboam and others. The idea seems to be here, it kind of appeals to politics, you might say, or just getting along with people in general. People love the new person. They love something new. They love the young guy who's going to take over the leadership position. But very shortly, it seems, after that new person is popularly received or placed in that position of leadership, it's not too long before what happens to that so-called popular person. Their popularity goes down again. People come to hate him too. And so again, it's this cycle of popularity. We can attribute, we could see that in our leaders today. Everyone's so excited about a new president, right? Oh, we got a new president. Life is going to be better. It's going to get so much more improved. And it doesn't. Things change a little bit, but nothing really improves. And sometimes you can think, oh, well, if I just change, if I just become popular with this group of people, my life is going to be so much better. Did you ever try that? Even in the congregations, it happens in our church youth groups. You know, oh, if I become one of the popular people, then life will be so good. Does it always work out that way? I don't know what your experience has been. My thought, understanding the way people are, it only lasts for a little while. And then somebody else comes along who's more popular or whatever it might be. So it's a fact of life. Popularity is going to come and go. And no one is ever going to be satisfied with that person. Who's ever popular now will be laughed upon later, it seems. Let's see. Going on to chapter 5. Here's a fact of life that Solomon notes here. Verse 1 through 5 talks about be careful, a fact of life. The more words you speak, typically the more trouble you're going to get yourself into. I don't know if you've experienced that either. I have, and I still will if I'm not careful. Words, walk prudently when you go to the house of God and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Well, what's the sacrifice of fools? I'll just stop right here. What do you think the sacrifice of fools is when we draw near the house of God? He says, walk prudently when you go to the house of God, draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. What do you suppose the sacrifice of fools is? You can look at the next verse real quick, and I think you get the clue. What is it? Yeah, talking. Talking. Sacrifice of fools is too many words. It's better when we draw near the house of God, when we go to worship God, it's better that we listen and then we talk. And sometimes what we talk is our own opinions, or arguing with what we hear or something maybe. We should seek to learn from God, seems to be the point. Do not be rash with your mouth. Let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. Now, of course, here he's starting to address more specifically making vows, promises. A vow before God, the two most important vows you're ever going to make in your life, do you know what those are? Most important vow you're going to make is what? Baptism, very good. And what's the next most important vow you're going to make? In marriage, that's right. And those are forever. You're never to break those. You make those with God. And even from there, promises may not have the same weight as vows before God. But even then, if you give your word, if you say you're going to do something, what should you do? You should really do it. Perhaps even to your own hurt. If you make a promise and later on regret it, well, you can, Proverbs would say, go to that person you made the promise to and see if you can work your way out of it. Maybe you promised something that you didn't really think through. But otherwise, if you're going to make a promise, you should keep it. Your word should mean something is the point. Here we're speaking a little more specifically about our words to God. Do not be rash with your mouth. Do not let your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. God is going to judge us. God is going to hold us to account for what we say. Then he adds this, for a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by many words. Sometimes we speak too quickly. We speak wishes and promises, things we really don't control. It also seems to suggest don't be preoccupied with our own dreams, our own hopes and plans. Be sure our hopes and dreams, if you might want to put it that way, are more closely tied in with God's will. And just be a little more cautious. Even we're told be careful of saying, well, on this day I'm going to do such and such. Well, a little wisdom says, well, God wills, if things go according to plan, this is what we're going to do on that day. That just shows a little more reverence for God, that He is in charge and not we ourselves. When you make a vow to God, verse 4, do not delay to pay it, for He has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. And so vows are really what we're talking about. A vow is a commitment, sometimes lifelong commitment, as in baptism or marriage. And that is something you don't rush into. That's something you don't want to just quickly say, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, I promise, I do. And then you've never thought about, well, after you said I do in marriage, what does that mean? After you say I do to God in baptism, have you really thought through what that commitment means? One of many reasons we don't baptize, you know, little kids, because they often, I don't think, would understand what a lifelong commitment means, right? But older people do. And it can vary to culture, but among cultures, but typically adults have a better understanding what a commitment means. They've held down a long-term job. They've been able to pay their bills on time. And so on, whatever it might mean. Let's see another fact here. Verse 8, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. And so it's a fact of life, he says, that we're going to see oppression under the sun. And he's even suggesting perversion of justice. We're going to see bribery. Bribes occur. Injustice occurs. Notice he's not saying it's right. He's saying you're going to see it. Do not marvel at the matter. I do not marvel at the matter. It sickens me. That's what it does to me. And we can see perversion of justice in our society. We can see the influence of money in turning the eyes of, you know, the little guy will be treated differently under law than somebody that's very wealthy. That often happens. That is not right. It's a fact of life. It's part of what happens under the sun. It happened back in Solomon's time. So do not marvel over it. I think the impression is that's not something we should be doing. Of course, if we're fearing God and keeping His commandments, we know we are not to be perverting justice. And if it's within our ability, we should seek to make sure true justice occurs according to God's law and ways. Then he continues on talking about riches. Verse 10, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. We're never happy. You get something more, you want more. If he who loves abundance with increase, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. It's really silly. You know, it kind of ties into 1 Timothy 6:10. Money is not of itself evil. It's the love of money. It's the love of wealth that destroys. Wealth can do a lot of wonderful things in this life under the sun. But to love it, and just to love it, to have it for the sake of having more of it, it's wrong. And also that becomes a means of being a miser. And we are not meant to be miserly. We are to practice a generosity, a magnanimity of mind, a generosity of mind, of spirit, and of the things God blesses us with. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? Some people just like gaining more land, gaining more property. Maybe when you're really, really little, you collected Beanie Babies. Anybody collect Beanie Babies? Okay. No, you don't even remember. Whatever it was. Maybe it's Hot Wheel cars. No? No, okay, whatever. But you just kept having more and more and more. What do you learn about more? It's not always better, is it? More is not always better. Sometimes more is just more, and it's not satisfying. And if we can learn that young, I think we're better off as we get old. You can enjoy counting, seeing how many dollars you have in your bank account. You could collect friends on Facebook. Ooh, I got 1,000 friends. Do you really? But yet I've known people do that, haven't you? You heard things like that? That's not necessarily good. So there is something, sometimes having more is not better. When we're talking about more property, more wealth, oftentimes what it gives us is just more worries, more sleepless nights, more what happens if I lose this money or whatever it might be. It gives us more things to fret about. We worry about protecting our whatever we have. Whereas verse 12, he makes a different contrast. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. And you all probably sleep pretty well, right? You don't have much. Neither do I, in many ways. But, you know, there's a benefit of just working, being a good worker, being generous, living life according to God's way of life, not being covetous, not being greedy, sharing the good that God gives us, whether it's little or much. That gives us a peace of mind that allows us to sleep well at night. And Solomon recognized that as a fact of life. Having an abundance makes you wonder, did Solomon sleep well at night? Having an abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. With much riches is much anxiety. You ever wonder why God hasn't made you a millionaire yet? Maybe you don't want to be. But, you know, maybe because he's actually blessing us by not allowing us to become millionaires. Maybe he wants us to have more peace of mind. Verse 13, again, we get this idea of miserliness. I'm covering this because I think materialism, this desire for riches, is an illness in our Western society, and it's spreading throughout the world, of course. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. They're being miserly and greedy, but what is the real benefit? Verse 14, but those riches perish through misfortune. You know, you can lose it. Stock markets crash, you can lose it. We have so much debt now. The whole world is pretending there's not this trillion upon trillion dollars of debt. We're pretending it doesn't exist, because if we start talking about admitting it, the stock market's going to crash because nobody has enough money to pay the debts that are owed. Those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there's nothing in his hand. So riches can come, but they can easily go. And as he who came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor which he may carry away in his hand. It's a reminder, and you've probably heard this, you can't take it with you, right? You can't take it with you. In fact, there's a book came out years ago, this guy's point, his philosophy was you should die broke. Your goal in life should be to die broke. Sounds weird, right? But his point is, why spend your whole life accruing riches for yourself when you could be using those riches to help other people, to share with your family, make sure your family has a nice little nest egg. Sometimes people, when they die at these huge estates, guess who gets most of the estate? The government. The government. There's inheritance tax, then there's a death tax, and then there's an inheritance tax. And how much do you get? Very little. So it's a fact of life. Naked we came, naked we shall go. And so the idea Solomon seems to be suggesting, if you're going to fear God and keep his commandments, give, share, help others. Share your blessings from God. There is a joy in life that comes in giving, not in getting, in coveting. And that doesn't matter if you have a lot or if you have a little. If you have the spirit of generosity, a spirit of giving, which also is God's spirit, his approach and attitude towards life, you're going to be far happier than those who are miserly, who just want to cling to everything they have. Verse 16, this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. For what profit is he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow, sickness, and anger. This is Solomon's take on people who are miserly. They're not in the light of God. They're really miserable, and they don't know it. They don't know it. They have much money, but what about good and right relationships? It seems they don't even have a right relationship with God. And again, we see that theme over and over again. And that's interesting coming from Solomon, because Solomon was given more riches. He has more wealth than any other king before him in Jerusalem. And so we can look at this example from Solomon, and my take would be, I need to listen to him. Here's somebody that had it all. And he's telling me that's not what it's all about. Having more toys doesn't make you happier. Here's what I've seen, verse 18. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun, all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. So how should we be living out our lives? By coveting, by clinging onto stuff? He says, no. Eat and drink. Eat and enjoy companionship, relationships with others, your family and friends. Enjoy the good of your labor. There's a sense of fulfillment in doing a job well done. This is not a dour, sad, depressing message. But Solomon is telling us, yes, life has a lot of monotony, but you don't have to be caught up and ruined by that so-called monotony. Use it well. Share. Practice godly living, generosity, and kindness. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. That's a gift God gives us under the sun, this physical existence, to eat well, to enjoy company, to share in the labor, our benefits of our labor, the increase of our labor. That's part of what God gives us to enjoy. That's a positive message. People that do that, he says, verse 20, for he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. So if we're focused on God and keeping his commandments, and we have a godly attitude and a godly approach, we're not going to get in the doldrums so easily. I'm not saying we won't have times when we feel blue and a little depressed, because life affects all of us, but we don't have to stay there. If your focus is on God, you're going to get back and stay right with God. You're going to be generous. You're going to share, enjoy right relationships. So if we live life to please God and keep money second, third, fourth in life, we're going to be far happier. We're going to have far more pleasant life. It's hard to do because our consumerism society is constantly telling us, where is happiness found? Where is happiness found according to TV commercials? Well, that doesn't come in money. Happiness comes from spending your money. Spending your money buying this newest, what, iPhone 10? What is it, like $1,000 now? I don't know. I'm not buying it. I'm almost tempted to go back to my flip phone. Life was easier back then, you know. But the idea of consumerism tells us we got to stay happy by buying things, staying trendy. God says, keep me first. Eat, drink, enjoy the pleasant, blessed things of life. Build right relationships with God and man. That's your good life. And that's really not necessarily something money can buy, is it? Let's see. So that's going to give us more of a fulfilled life if we're living life focused on God, loving our neighbor, doing what we can to help other people. Let's see. I want to skip ahead. Chapter 6 is pretty short. We have more repetition of the same idea, the vanity of riches. New King James subtitle puts it, the wealth is not the goal of life. NIV calls it the unfulfilled life. And again, it harps about materialism. Let's look at verse 3, just to get a flavor of this chapter. Verse 3 through 6, if a man begets 100 children, I wonder who may have begotten 100 children. I don't know how many children Solomon had. He had quite a few wives and concubines, right? If a man begets 100, the New King James put the word children in there. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, I think NIV says, but his soul is covetous or greed drives him, or indeed, he has no burial. I say that a stillborn child is better than he. So again, this person may have had all these children. He may have all these blessings. But if he's not driven by the right thing in life, by greed and covetousness or materialism, a stillborn child is better than he. For the stillborn child, it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. So, though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, and do not all go to one place. What Solomon seems to be suggesting is that there's a difference between living life God's way and not living life God's way. Some people that get so caught up in materialism, he seems to be suggesting that they're existing, but they're really not living life. They're living, but they're not living. I'm intrigued by our society's interest in zombies right now. And that they've been interested in zombies for a long time. What are zombies? The living what? The living dead. Is Solomon talking about the living dead? They're living, but they're miserable. And he's suggesting a stillborn child is probably better off than these people that lived and accumulated all this wealth and all these children and all this, but yet they're miserly. They're never happy. I think there may be some living dead. Maybe that's part of what Solomon's addressing here, that attitude and approach. It's out of sync with God's way of life. Here's some practical wisdom, chapter 7. Let's look at verses 1 through 6. A good name is better than precious ointment. My mom and dad encouraged me about my name. They said, my name is the only thing that's really mine. Don't ruin it. Don't ruin the family reputation, I guess is what they're getting to. A good name is better than precious ointment. I've shared that same lesson to my kids. Don't do anything to ruin your reputation. A good name is better than precious ointment. And the day of death, better than the day of one's birth. That seems odd. Why is the day of death better than one's birth? Any ideas? Austin?
Is it because when you die, you've got a bit of a reputation, but when you're born, you don't really have anything that you start off with?
Okay. Anything else? Anybody want to add to that? Okay, Cameron?
When you die, you've fulfilled more of a purpose, you know?
Okay.
You come to a conclusion.
Yeah.
And everything.
So the idea is your day of death should be better because you've lived a long, full life. The idea, if you've lived it according in fear of God, you've lived a long life. You've helped many people. You've been a light to others. You've worshiped God. You've built right relationships. When you're born, your story is unwritten, we might say. Your life is unwritten. When you die, if you've lived your life well, there is reason for rejoicing in your death. You've lived a good life. And ultimately, of course, we hope your name's written in the book of life. Okay, that's something we'll tie with that analogy. Better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. Why is that true? You've heard this before. Why is it better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting or partying? Any ideas there? Okay, Austin.
Because it's better to be sober-minded than to be, I don't know what the word is, drunken-minded.
Well, isn't that kind of what Solomon said back in chapter 1? You know, he's talking about people that just want to drink wine and all this, the way of foolishness. Let's read, because he answers this question, doesn't he? Better go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting or partying, is what some translations say. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter. We don't like sorrow, but I think it's more meaningful, more long-lasting and helpful to us perhaps than just wanting to laugh all the time. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. We take life more seriously when we go through hard times. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth or the house of partying. And so the idea is that we should take life seriously, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't laugh and enjoy life too. He's talking about extremes, I guess. You don't want to spend your whole life. Life is one big party, and that's what we want to do. He's not taking away laughter. We've read elsewhere that laughter and eating well, that's part of life too. But the idea is that life, it should be more than just pleasing the self with food, drink, and fun. Mirth alone by itself becomes a type of vanity. I want to look at verse 10 through 12 because some of us older folk will say this. Verse 10 through 12, do not say, why were the former days better than these? You ever hear people say things like that? How do we phrase it? Back in my age, back in the good old days, I walked through snow 6 inches deep back and forth to country school and I valued my education and okay. Do you want to go back and live in those days, Grandma? Oh, no. Well, why not? Oh, it was hard. It was so hard. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. In other words, don't yearn for the good old days. Now, I get as nostalgic as anybody, I suppose. I like when life was when people could not reach out and touch me wherever I were. You know what I mean by that? It was nice when the only way you could get to a phone was by going to either someone's house or to a payphone and not having somebody being able to reach you any second of life, unless you're in a dead zone somewhere, which is an interesting phrase. But so I do get nostalgic every now and then. The idea is, yeah, we should learn from the past, but we need to be living in the present and with an eye to the future. Yes, there are things we need to learn from our history, absolutely, but we shouldn't yearn to be going backwards. God created us as creatures to be living in a forward motion, right? In a forward movement. Solomon seems to be pointing that out to us. So be careful of being nostalgic for the good old days. Oh, when I got in my 20s, I started thinking, oh, life is so good. When I lived at home, Mom always had meals made, and Dad took care of the car. He'd always have gasoline in the car. Oh, the good old days of childhood, you know, 5 years ago or whatever it was at that time in my life. But no, you don't want to go backward. You got your whole life ahead of you. You want to be looking forward, seems to be the point. This is a good one for us. Verse 14, it's sort of a proverb. Verse 14, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. So God's, in a sense, we're not always going to have bad days. There are going to be days we see, we're going to feel like we have a little more prosperity. The point is, enjoy the gift of prosperity. But in the days of adversity, consider. So when the days aren't as well, aren't as prosperous and things aren't always as good, the idea is that we shouldn't hate the bad days, nor should we overly rejoice in the good days. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. Or, that doesn't make much sense in the New King James, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. NIV has this, surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, prosperity and adversity, so that man can find out anything, let's see, so that man can find out anything about his future. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. I'm reading from my notes. The point is here, we need to accept both the good and the bad. We need to live in obedience to God, no matter what may happen to us, the good or the bad. The idea is prosperity or adversity both come from God. God allows both to come from our way. Part of faith in God, knowing God and believing God, obeying God, is to believe that He knows what He's doing. Whether things are going well for us or not so well, if we continue to look to God for those times, we know that good times and bad times are God's way of preparing us, making us better prepared for what the future is going to have. And that's a positive thing. And so here you could say that we need to be upbeat in times of trial, times of when things don't seem so good to us. Ultimately, God's perspective, they're going to be all right. Okay, I'm going to let you, we'll stop there. I'm going to let you go for now. And we'll carry on from there. And I'll put on roller skates tomorrow, so to speak. And we'll go through these and wrap up Ecclesiastes tomorrow.